Last time we had been talking about social morality in mere Christianity, social morality and morality in psychoanalysis. And tonight we're going to talk about sexual morality and Christian marriage. And as I said last time, we'll have a couple of weeks off, but we will pick up again from the Lewis study, because next week is the Christmas dinner, the week after is the children's musical at night, and the week after that is Christmas caroling. But the 26th we will pick up again in Lewis, and we'll continue in January and finish up in January with the book. But talking about, he was talking about the different types of morality as he began book three, and in particular he talked about the three particular parts of morality, which we dealt with a couple of weeks ago, as well as the cardinal virtues. And last week we were talking about social morality and how we can change society, but how we cannot legislate morality in order to change society. That has to be something that comes from within. And the difficulties when it comes to social morality, we would love to have this wonderful utopian world in which to live and this utopian lifestyle, but the difficulty is free choice, free will. The ability to choose to accept God and follow God and be moral, or the ability to choose not to follow God and be immoral. And sometimes if we were if we looked at what might be the utopia found in the biblical text, and in particular in the New Testament, we might not like some of that stuff. Because the haves would have to give to the have-nots, and because we would not raise our voices to other people, and we would not judge anybody, nor would we be judged by them. Everyone would, it'd almost be communal, almost, as he mentioned, almost socialist economically, but very old-fashioned when it comes to family life and manners and those kinds of things. And because of human nature, that probably wouldn't last all that long. As I said, one writer about 30 years ago said that if everyone woke up tomorrow and had exactly the same amount of money, the same amount of property, the same status in society throughout the whole world, by lunchtime there would be wars and skirmishes everywhere because somebody would want something more. So the hope for social morality is free choice, but also the bane of social morality is free choice. But God Himself chose to give us that ability to exercise free will so that we would not only know what was good, but we would know how to seek to overcome that which is bad, because we would experience that which is bad. And God trusts in us to, at some point in time, hopefully, come around to God, which makes it more meaningful for us when we do. So that's kind of where we were. And we talked a little bit about Uncle Sigmund Freud and others last time, and how Freud didn't make a whole lot of sense. In psychoanalysis, the medical scientific part, yes, but when it came to then getting down to the inner person and the true morals and where those come from, Freud falls apart. So we moved from that, and we found that Christian morality is not a bargaining place where God says, if you keep these rules, then I will reward you. Rather, He wants us to choose to change and to seek knowledge and to change relationships with Himself, and subsequently then with each other. And that has to come from inside. It's not something the psychiatrist can give you. Now, he moves on beyond that to a discussion of sexual morality, looking into Christian morality towards sex, especially when it comes to the whole idea of chastity, the social rules concerning chastity, that Christian virtue. And one of the questions that comes is, how is Christian chastity different than simply social rules of modesty? how is Christian chastity different than just normal, conventional kinds of senses of morality that change so much? Okay. We don't change with the times. We stick to what God says. And Lewis says that when it comes to Christian chastity, as opposed to social rules of modesty and what is acceptable, which changes with time, society, sometimes for the better, oftentimes for the worse, he talks in particular about marriage. And he says we're talking about either marriage with complete faithfulness or total abstinence. That's the Christian chastity idea. The whole idea of chastity there is you either are married with complete faithfulness, that's the ideal. You're married with complete faithfulness, or there's total abstinence. Society, and especially these days, society throws their hands up, and you know, it's almost like throwing it up in the air, and it's kind of like I was reminded yesterday when I was at the hospital, and we were just talking about a variety of things, and some, at one point telling some different jokes and that kind of thing. And it reminded me of the way not only people do with money sometimes, but the way we do with our morals. Baptist, Roman Catholic, and Jewish. Baptist minister, Roman Catholic priest, and Jewish rabbi. Well, that's kind of redundant because a rabbi is Jewish. But and they were talking about money and how they decided what went to the church and what went to the ministries outside of the church. Including what happens with, you know, pay of staff and missions and other things. And a Baptist said, well, we draw a circle. Y'all might have heard this before. We draw a circle on the ground and we throw the money up in the air. And whatever falls inside stays in the church, and whatever falls outside goes to other ministries. And the Catholic priest said, well, we have a similar way of doing things, only whatever stays inside the circle goes to the outside ministries, and whatever falls outside we keep within the church. The rabbi said, oh, y'all do it all wrong. He said, we draw the circle and we throw the money up in the air, and what the Lord wants, he gets to keep. I'll let that sink in a second. Well, sometimes it seems that our morals have gotten that way in society. It's not so much now about, in a lot of areas, about what God, what we find in the biblical text and what God might prescribe for us, as we just toss it up in the air, and whatever falls, whatever shakes out, as we used to say, whatever shakes out, that's where we are. And it doesn't always shake out on the inside, but on the outside of the circle. And yet, we find within that whole idea of social mores and social realities, we find that there's nothing within Christian teaching, there's nothing to be ashamed of in the fact the human race reproduces in a certain way, as Lewis says, nor in the fact that that gives pleasure. Christianity is the one religion that actually glorified marriage more than any other religion. However, it's the unbridled sexual tendencies that should we of which we should be ashamed. Christianity, if you look at it, Christianity more than any other world religion talks more in positive terms about marriage and about sexual action within marriage than any other religion in the world. And sees it as something that is good. But other religions tend to not do so, and that's what really kind of makes things so difficult throughout history, but even today, especially today, is that the current state of unbridled sexual instinct is what we should be ashamed of. It is unbridled rather than being within certain confines. And Lewis talked about that in World War II. It's going on today. I don't know if it's going on today in a greater, that is, a more prolific way as much as we see it more. it's all out there in your face, right? On the news or on the news magazine shows and other things too. There was a very famous Christian who was later a bishop in the church as it developed, who prayed for chastity with his lips, but he later said that in his heart, he said, "I prayed for chastity with my mouth and with my lips, but in my heart I said, but please, don't do it just yet." Augustine. I want to be chaste, I want to be faithful, but not just yet. So, a lot of folks look at the ideas of Christian chastity and think it's impossible. I mean, especially in today's society, we're bombarded everywhere. I mean, they used to use girls in scantily clad outfits to sell cars. Now it's in scantily clad outfits to sell anything, right? Even food. What's that commercial that was on not too long? Was it the Hardee's Thick Burger? And the woman that was in very scantily clad and the way she ate the Thick Burger, what did that have to do with the hamburger? It didn't. Except it was trying to reach a certain segment of society. Do you think that Christian chastity is impossible? Seriously, do you think it's impossible? I see a few heads shaking. I hear a few no's and a lot of people just sitting. According to Lewis, the most fatal thing that we can do when faced with this idea of Christian chastity is to think that it's impossible. Oh, well, nobody can live that way, especially today. But there are people out there that will say that. And there are folks in churches who preach sermons on sex in marriage, sex outside of marriage, all that kind of stuff in a very crass, almost vulgar kind of way, joking, laughing. There is one that sometime back in the last year or so did a sermon on sex in the bedroom, and the minister and his wife were wheeled out at the time for the sermon onto a stage in their pajamas in a bed. And a colleague of mine's good friend, who is a minister at a church in the upstate, went on this Sunday afternoon for this afternoon service, which had gone on at 11 o'clock in the morning as well, or 10 o'clock in the morning as well, same sermon. And this guy said, there were things said from the quote-unquote pulpit that I don't want my teenage daughters learning anywhere except at home. Unfortunately, sometimes people try to dumb down those things too much. And Lewis says some of the most fatal things we can do, first of all, comes from our warped natures and contemporary advertisements. That by putting so much stock in those, we end up warping our natures even more and our society even more. Oftentimes people think chastity is impossible, but we are to keep trying to improve. It becomes fatal when we become content with less than seeking perfection. And I think that's not just about chastity, though that is an area where we need to work on it. But he says where it becomes fatal is when we become content. So, well, you know, nobody's doing that anymore. Nobody's living that way anymore. So why should I? We become content with the status quo rather than we let society change us rather than we change society. We get called prudes. Well, they don't call us prudes anymore. They use other words. But and people are afraid of being labeled that way and stigmatized. But Lewis says we must keep trying to improve. It's fatal when we become content with less than seeking perfection. And my personal warped way of looking at things is it's not just about sexual morality. It's in most everything in our Christian walk. When we become content with less than trying to reach that perfection, then eventually we kind of beat our consciences into oblivion. And instead of rising to a higher denominator, we're content to sink to a lower denominator and stay there. He also says that we must be conscious of our sexuality and seek to deal with it positively. It says, virtue, even attempted virtue, brings light into life. Indulgence brings fog. Or as we said this morning, darkness. We should be aware of the virtue, and we should attempt to live by the virtue, and in so doing, that brings light to our lives, as opposed to simply saying, well, I can't be that virtuous, so we indulge, which puts us in darkness or the fog. And when we end up in the fog, in the darkness, then we run the risk of finding our spirituality in a fatal situation. So, is unchastity the supreme Christian vice? Is unchastity the supreme Christian vice? Living wrongly in sins of the flesh? Lewis says no. See if you agree. The sin, page 102. At the bottom, if anyone thinks that Christians regard unchastity as supreme vice, he is quite wrong. The sins of the flesh are bad, but they are at least bad. They are the least bad of all sins. All the worst pleasures are purely spiritual. The pleasure of putting other people in the wrong, of bossing and patronizing and spoiling sport and backbiting, the pleasures of power and of hatred. For there are two things inside me competing with the human self which I must try to become. They are the animal self and the diabolical self. The diabolical self is the worse of the two. That is why a cold, self-righteous prig, he didn't say pig, a cold, self-righteous prig who goes regularly to church may be far nearer to hell than a prostitute. Of course, it's not good to be either. He is saying that there are things we can end up staying away from sexual vices, but for the wrong reasons. That the inner self and the vices that are even worse than sexual immorality are those things which find us getting pleasure out of putting people down, out of bossing people around, out of backbiting, out of hatred. In other words, the diabolical self, that which Jesus says you should in the Sermon on the Mount. You heard it said to the men of old, you shall not kill or commit murder. But I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother is liable to counsel. Jesus says, you've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, everyone who looks with lust upon another has committed the act of adultery. What Lewis is saying here is, it's not okay just to say, well, I'm not going to do the outer action, when inside, you wish you could. It goes back to what's inside. The self that can be diabolical or that can strive toward perfection, which then comes out in the outer action. Jesus says that it's all the law, the heart of the law is the heart. Lewis mentions it here when it comes to sexual morality and the end of that, but it's not just about sexual morality and virtue. It is about the heart in everything we do. Yet, sexual morality is one of the baser instincts that we have. What did God say according to Genesis chapter 1 after creating humanity? God says to them, be what? The guy that... That's right, Al. Fruitful. I was going to say, if nothing else, flip over and watch this guy. I can't believe the guy's got a TV show as a polygamist and he's making all kinds of money. You know. Be fruitful and multiply. God gave those... The guy that's got the four wives that has a TV show. Whatever the name of it is. But he's got a few screws loose. Or maybe he's, when you say space, the final frontier, it means you're talking about what's between his ears. But it's about what's in the heart, Jesus says. And yes, God created us as sexual beings, but at the same time, God created that for certain purposes and not to be unbridled. I guess we need to have a barn, right, where we keep the bridles. When it comes to Christian marriage, then, he says, Lewis in the next chapter says that the sexual impulse in human beings works best in Christian marriage. It works best in marriage, period. But it should work the very best in Christian marriage. In part because we are not seeking our own good totally, but as Christians we are told to seek the good of others and to provide for that partner. The very first, what is considered the very first, and this is an easy one, miracle of Jesus was, bless you, was doing what? Water to wine at a wedding. Jesus was blessing that marriage, blessing that wedding, blessing that union, as well as challenging, promising us, I will do nothing but the very best for you, but then challenging His disciples to do their very best. Jesus changes water into wine, but it's not cheap wine. It's not Ripple. It's not Boone's Farm. It's not what the... Pass the word Thunderbird. Y'all might remember that commercial that was on several years ago and the people dancing around and said, pass the word Thunderbird. It wasn't what, when I was in high school, we called the rot gut stuff because it'd rot out your guts. The wine steward comes along and he drinks up, he tastes it and he says to the bridegroom, this is great. You saved the best for last. Normally everyone serves okay wine until everybody's two or three sheets in the wind and then they bring out the stuff that's changing over to vinegar to get rid of it. But you save the best for last. Jesus was not only saying, I will do the best, but in front of those disciples who witnessed this, Jesus was challenging them to always do their best in everything from the heart. The words, one flesh, as Lewis mentions, the words, one flesh in modern English could be translated and they became a single organism because that's what it means. Page 104. The Christian idea of marriage is based on Christ's words that a man and wife are to be regarded as a single organism, for that is what the words one flesh would be in modern English in his time. And is that not what it's supposed to be anyway? The two become one organism together. It's not supposed to be one lording over another. But the two become one organism together. But ask if you've read or if you remember. What does Lewis say here? And he's probably right. According to Lewis, the most common reason for people who get married in church simply as a formality is what? They want the respectability of marriage without intending to pay the price. When I counsel with folks, you know, we talk about a variety of things. I mentioned this morning, we talk about you can't have a duffel bag, a war chest, where you tuck those little incidents in that you're going to bring out later to use in battle and to beat up the other person. We talk about all kinds of things. I ask them all kinds of questions to see what they know and try and give them a heads up on I asked them things about the first thing that attracted them. They each get a shot at it, and why. And the one thing I follow that up with, if I start with the guy on that and then the young lady, then I'll turn to her, or vice versa, whichever starts, and I'll turn to the other one and say, okay, now it's your turn. What's the one thing they do or the one habit they have that annoys you the most? I've got to get this out right here at the front end of everything. But we also talk about what is the number one stressor in a marriage that people fight over. Absolutely, Francis, money. Money. Yours, mine, ours. I'm finding more and more young people these days have multiple pots. He has his money, she has her money, and they have a pot of money to pay bills. And while she can do anything she wants to with what's left over of her money, and he can do anything he wants to with what's left over of his money, and I say, okay, well, then what happens when that pot out there, which pays the bills, all of a sudden you got an emergency and you need money? Well, I guess we'll have to talk about that. Well, yeah, you need to talk about it before you get married, not after you get married. Number two, stressor. Just out of curiosity. Yep, children. A, are we going to have them? B, how many? And C, how we're going to raise them? Who's going to be the disciplinarian and who's going to be the... they're always saying no, so I'm going to over here and... The three. Sometimes this gets involved with holidays and other things. In-laws and outlaws. What I simply say is, number three is the laws. I say, huh? I'll say, in-laws, outlaws, and sometimes laws. Oh, we don't have any problem. I say, wait till that first Thanksgiving or Christmas, that first child comes along. And whose house are you going to go to when? And especially when one's an hour away and the next one's 5 hours away. Or it may be even worse when one's around the street corner from the other, right? But in getting to that, we also talk about, and I tell them that, quite frankly, I think that when a marriage takes place, we probably need to post a sign outside that says, adults only. I've said this before in church, adults only. Not because it's X-rated, but because you need to approach it as an adult. Not as a kid thinking, if the toy gets broken, I'm just going to go on get something else. Or, a 30,000-mile oil change. And I tell folks, if you think that, we'll try this for a while, but if it doesn't go along well, we can always get out of it, then I'm not doing the marriage ceremony. As far as I know, in all the years, I've only had one that's not still together. So, but why? Just as a mere formality, they don't intend to pay the price. You say, well, why don't you go over here and get married, or why are you getting married in the church? Well, because it'll make our parents happy. Well, you're just not wanting to pay the price. You're not thinking about yourselves together. You're thinking about other things. And Lewis says, living together outside of marriage causes one to be guilty on two counts: fornication and perjury. Now, fornication is pretty obvious. Why perjury? Because you're kind of lying to yourself and everybody else. And most of the time, a lot of times, those don't last even if they do get married. They ruin a good friendship, or what they thought was a friendship. I mentioned this article last time, Pew Research study. 4 in 10 Americans say that marriage is becoming obsolete. As families gather for Thanksgiving this year, nearly 1 in 3 American children is living with a parent, divorced, separated, or never married. But more people are accepting the view wedding bells aren't needed. Um, 29% of children under 18 now live with a parent or parents who are unwed, a fivefold increase from 1960. 15% have parents who are divorced or separate. 14% have parents who were never married. 6% have parents who are simply live-in couples who opted to raise kids without ever getting married. 39% of Americans said marriage is becoming obsolete. A sentiment, and that sentiment follows U.S. Census data released in September showed marriages hit an all-time low of 52% for adults 18 and over. In 1978, 28% of people believed marriage would become obsolete. When asked what constitutes a family, the vast majority of Americans agreed a married couple with or without children fits that description. But 4 out of 5 surveyed pointed also to unmarried opposite-sex couples with children, to single parents, and 3 out of 5 people said a same-sex couple with children should be considered a family. And this is a recent study done by the Pew Research Group. People are rethinking what family means. Given the growth, I think we need to accept cohabitation relationships as a basis for some of the fringe benefits offered to families, such as and especially health insurance. Somebody's trying to fool somebody. Somebody's trying to fool somebody. So what does the passion of love impel two people to do? According to Lewis, it impels them to take seriously the idea of binding themselves together by promises. Promises about things I can do and things that will do good. That's what the passion of love impels two people to do. To take seriously, that passion impels them to bind themselves by promises. Promises about things I can do and that they think do good. But being in love, he said, while it is good, is not the best thing. It doesn't mean to cease to love, but to love means a deep unity maintained by the will, strengthened by habit, and able to keep the promises of love. In other words, to love is deeper than simply saying, oh, that you're being in love. Because to love means a deep unity maintained by the will, strengthened by habit, which enables one to keep the promise of love. To love, according to Lewis, and I think probably in a lot of ways, I know people talk about, well, you say you love them, but are you still in love with them? See that on Dr. Phil and things, on commercials, you know. But I don't watch Dr. Phil. I think the guy's, well, never mind. But to truly love as opposed to being in love generally makes for a more lasting relationship. It's kind of like, you know, I like movies of various types, and I have all kinds of different movies that I have watched over the years. And I like some musicals. Some I can't stand, but I like some music. And I really like Fiddler on the Roof. I especially like Tevye when he's singing, "If I Were a Rich Man." But there is a song in there where Tevye, after the daughters have been, if you've ever seen that movie or seen the play, the daughters are marrying folks that really Tevye doesn't particularly approve of. You got the matchmaker. Of course, every time I hear that song, "Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match," I want to go, poof, you're a match. But just don't burn out. But Tevye and his wife are sitting there, and he's talking with her about love. And in the song, he says, do you love me? And she starts talking about you. I darn your socks. I clean the house. I cook your meals. I had your... But do you love me? And she goes on with something else and something else and something else. He says, but do you love me? And she goes on with a few other things, and then she says, I think I love you. And he says, and I think I love you too. After all of these years and doing all this, she said, I think I love you. And he says, I think I love you too. The point of that was, maybe in the beginning they weren't so sure, but they thought, and they had a marriage that they worked at, each doing his or her own part at working at it, and that's why it lasted through all this time, why it survived. It survived three daughters. And it was surviving being run out of Russia as Russian Jews. It was still going to survive. Not just because they were in love, but because they loved. To love, as opposed to being in love. When C.S. Lewis wrote this, he was not married, which is really kind of interesting. Some of the things that, you know, he talked about, and what about equality, and what about a head or not, and why should it be the man or not, and what are the needs there? And yet, you know, in the New Testament, when it says that the husband is the head of the wife, the word used for head there is not head as in I'm the authority, but it's the one who leads and cares for, who guides. It's not, and if you're going to guide someone, you end up on equal footing as you guide that person and help them along. Lewis did find out when he found Joy, and then such a short time, she died. And his book, A Grief Observed, is his journey through all of that, where he almost lost God, but never did quite lose God, and found his way back in faith, to a stronger faith. So it is kind of interesting that that he does this, and talking about those relationships. And he does admit, you know, some people might ask the question, wait a minute, how can you talk about this stuff and give advice when you hadn't even been there? Which is a question sometimes I wonder about priests. Wait a minute, how can you give advice on children and rearing children and all this kind of stuff and give it authoritatively when you don't have any, when you haven't been there? I had one guy, though, that I was listening to talk about it. Somebody asked him that question, a priest, and he said, oh, but I have children. I have my children in the church. All of the church members are my, all the parish members are my children. That still didn't explain how he knows how to raise them. But it takes work. And with Lewis, there is this idea that we should not force the laws of Christian marriage through government regulation, but we should come to understand the laws of Christian marriage because of who God has made us to be and who we are deep down inside. And that should govern us and govern our relationships with others, especially in Christian marriage. But if we can have that kind of relationship going on in Christian marriage, the concentric circles should go out to other relationships that we have. And I've run over by 3 minutes, and even though there's no choir practice tonight afterwards because we practiced at 4 o'clock, I'm not going to belabor the point and keep you all here late, although I thought about starting out saying, you know, there's no choir practice tonight, so we can stay here as long as we... But anything that you would add? Any questions? Any comments? He does compare it all with food. Yeah, that is an interesting... What do you think of his food analogies. That's right. That's right. Yeah. And with food, it's a question of, you know, what pleasure you get out of it and whether you can control those urges to overindulge or not, to eat the wrong things or not. You know, it's like my mother, who is diabetic and has candy in her house, and it's not all sugar-free candy. And while there are some diet drinks in the refrigerator, more times than not, it's a regular Pepsi that she pours out into the glass. I remember, what was Ms. Gibson's name at Hokie? Gladys Gibson. Thank you. Who was diabetic? She could make, hands down, some of the best pies you would have ever tasted in your life, and especially pecan pie and chess pie. And the doctor told her if she kept eating those sweets, because she was diabetic, she was going to lose her eyesight. And her eyesight started going, and the doctor kept telling her, and her husband kept telling her, but everything she made, she ate some of. And she ended up, sure enough. She said, but it tastes so good, and I've got to make sure that it's the best, and she ended up going blind. Because she overindulged in those things when she shouldn't. So it is that food analogy, Sarah, does come in there, as to whether you can control your food urges or your sexual urges. You know, those are basic drives within humanity to help us survive. He did kind of get at, even though he wasn't married, he did kind of get at it through foods, which makes me think that he probably liked, I know he liked to go to the pub, and he probably enjoyed good food and rich food as well. Next Sunday evening, we will be in here for the supper. Everybody's invited. If you hadn't already turned in a slip, got until Wednesday, you can tell me tonight. We'll write it down. I don't have a green slip with me, but we'll write it down. So we know how many for which to prepare. The following 2 weeks, we have things with children's musical and the Christmas caroling, which was a real big hit for everybody we went and saw last year, but I think it was a bigger hit for those folks who went and sang. We'll do that on the night of the 19th. The night of the 26th, we will pick up again with Lewis, and we'll talk about forgiveness, the great sin, and charity. Those are chapters 7, 8, and 9 in Book 3. Thank you for coming. Thank you for sharing. And thank you for allowing me to run over. God bless you. God keep you in His grace and His mercy. God give you His protection. And may you go in peace with God's grace. Amen.